Good morning. It's good to be with you again, every time. It's like home, right? I thoroughly enjoyed Mark's presentation the first hour, and just want to reiterate, we're going to be in the book of Revelation, as you can tell, and I would 100% agree with him. We need to be very careful when it comes to eschatology. We're talking about things that God has not worked out yet. He's in the process. So you need to be careful. Try to stick to the biblical text as closely as you can. God has given us enough to come to some conclusions, but sometimes, as Mark pointed out, Bible teachers go one step too far. In fact, even the book that he shared with us that somewhat awakened people to eschatology or Bible prophecy, even it is a little bit outdated, because even Hal Lindsey, I think, took things a little bit too far and tried to interpret things that probably should have been left a little bit more vague, I guess. So if you haven't already turned to the book of Revelation, I'm going to give you a flyover of it. We started this, when was it, a few months ago. I was here, and I gave you a little bit of it. I'll give you a quick review, and then we'll kind of pick up where we left off and hopefully get done with this overview. And again, it's the big picture. I'll make a few comments. Last time, I also wanted to mention that we're living, obviously, in difficult times and times that are uncertain. And one of the possibilities, and I want to stress that in light of not only what Mark said, but what I just mentioned, the possibilities is we may be very close to, we may be seeing the setting of the stage for some of the events that the book of Revelation are emphasizing. In fact, the bulk of the book deals with a future time. I believe the Bible calls it the tribulation, or the period of tribulation. Jesus describes it as the great tribulation. So again, I'm going to review some of that briefly in order to get through the biblical text. So I consider the book one of the most important of all of the Bible, because it brings together the plan of God, and not only that, but gives us hope, because obviously God has a plan not only for the world, but a plan for you and I, and in that it's very positive. It's obviously God wrapping things up before the eternal state, and the book of Revelation outlines all of that. And the whole emphasis of the book of Revelation is the Lion of the Tribe of Judah, a messianic phrase. In fact, Mark mentioned it this morning in Genesis 49:10, looking way ahead. This is Moses writing, and he's even in the context even before Moses. And in that time frame, God has already announced that there's going to be a Lion of the Tribe of Judah that's going to resolve lots of things. In other words, Judah is the chosen tribe of the Messiah. So that's what the book is all about. It's about the coming of the Messiah in the consummation of the ages. We looked at the first three chapters, which primarily deal with the vision that John sees, the things which you have seen, 1:19. But it also deals with the things which are, also 1:19, deals with seven historical churches that I took as probably typical of what you might see in any church, including our age as well. So I call that a summary of 1 through 3, the vision of Jesus Christ among the seven churches. And then we started the major division of the book, takes up almost three-quarters of the book, chapters 4 through 18, call it the tribulation from Jesus Christ. Now this, in verse 19, these are the things that are yet to come. In other words, the things that are about to come about in the future. And chapter 4 introduces us with that, and it mentions two times the little phrase that we find in chapter 19. So we started that. We saw the seven seal scroll. I break down the division into subdivisions, 4 through 7. We looked at all of that. And now we're going to start back in chapter 8 through 11. I touched on that. In fact, I think we got into chapter 9 even. And that goes, I see it, at least in my outline of the book, 8 through 11, trumpet judgments. Now, not entirely about trumpet judgments. There's an interlude in there, and there's a few other things part of it. But it's a good breakdown for that subdivision. Just a reminder again, chapters 1 through 3, you can put it on a timeline because I think that's what we have. We have a chronology. We have numbers. We have dates. Well, not dates, but time frames, you might say. Chapters 1 through 3, before this period of time, and I don't think the book of Revelation describes per se the rapture, might be hinted at in chapter 4, but not explicitly, because I think the book of Revelation, you need to think Jewish. You need to think in terms of a Jewish thinking because eschatology is Jewish. In fact, I say world history is Jewish, so that would mean that eschatology is Jewish. The church fits within it, that particular time frame, and the church does not have a chronology or a time frame. Israel does. In fact, there's a week of Israel's history that is yet future from our time, that has never taken place, Daniel's 70th week, and I take it that Revelation 4 through 18 is a description of that seven-year period. And it's very specific, so it's broken down into two parts. In fact, Daniel does that, and the book of Revelation picks up on that. We call that the tribulation. And continuing after that, we have a second coming of Christ, and he will introduce the kingdom. The kingdom is not now. The kingdom, the millennial kingdom, is future. Very specific, Revelation chapter 20. And in that period of time, God is going to wrap up all things, wrap up world history, resolve the issue of evil that is even pronounced and predicted in Genesis 3:15. Genesis 3:15 is going to be fulfilled. Jesus is going to resolve the seed of the woman, is going to resolve the issue of evil, and that's what the rest of world history is all about, and then you go into the eternal state. In fact, the book of Revelation describes part of the eternal state. That's why I kind of overlap across the line there on the slide there. So, let's take a look again at the first four trumpet judgments, chapter 8. Beginning in verse 6, is that right? Yeah, the seventh seal is 1 through 5, and then 6 through 13, first four trumpet judgments. This is just a flyover. I can't give you the details, but it's horrendous. In fact, the book of Revelation is not difficult to understand. It's pretty straightforward, but it's difficult to comprehend the scale. We're talking about global. These things have never taken place before, but they are on a global scale, hard to imagine. In fact, in one place, a third of all of mankind is destroyed. Can you imagine that? Billions of people. Then in another place, a quarter is destroyed. And if you add up the two, you end up with half the population of the entire world destroyed. And that's through a series of judgments. I won't give you the specific locations. First four, just a sampling of it. Seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound them. So now we're talking about trumpets. The first sounded, and three came, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood, and they were thrown to the earth. So we're talking about global here. And a third of the earth was burned up. Can you imagine that? Now this is throughout the world. But think of it continental in scope, almost an entire continent, you would think. if you would put it all together. But spread out over all the continents, we're talking about an entire, like a continent being destroyed all at once in one judgment. And a third of the trees were burned up and all the green grass, etc. And as you go through them, there's four of them that start off that have something in common. They all have a few things in common. And it's not clear how these relate. In other words, how do the seal judgments, we talked a little bit about them. Now the trumpet judgments, and then chapter 16, we're going to get the bowl judgments. How do they relate? Scholars differ on that. The way I take it is I think chapter 6 is a panoramic picture of the entire tribulation period. And then the trumpet judgments, I think, come later. We don't have a starting point, so we can't be dogmatic on it. But I see them somewhat parallel. Some scholars take them sequentially. In other words, all of the seals. And then within the seventh, you have the seven trumpets, and then the following there. And then after the trumpets, the bowl judgments. I see them more in parallel, and I've got some reasons for that, but we won't go into the detail because this is just a flyover. So, fifth and sixth trumpets, these are even more horrendous. They seem to be invasions of demonic spirits that permeate the entire world. And you can get a little bit of a feel for it. A lot of visual pictures there of things that are very, very strange, somewhat hard to interpret. Bottom line, I think you have an army of 200 million, and they're probably demon-possessed soldiers, the way the description is described in chapter 9, actually through 21. And just a feel for it, 9, 1 through 3, then the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven, which had fallen to the earth, and the key to the bottomless pit was given to him. So this is demonic, satanic. He opened the bottomless pit, then out of the smoke came locusts upon the earth, and power was given them as the scorpions of the earth have power. A lot of visual pictures here. This is the best that John can describe. He's seeing things that are indescribable, you might say. And in that, he gives us some details. And I think the bottom line, I think he's describing demonic spirits in some way that manifest in a very unusual and a actually scary way. Verses 4 and 5, and they were told not to hurt the grass of the earth, but only the men. So very specific. This is unusual. This is strange. This is supernatural. God is bringing judgment on the earth. Men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. Now in chapter 7, there's 144,000 that become believers. They're described as saints. And they have a particular role. I'll try to fit them in the chronology as best as we can discern. Those are the ones that are sealed on their foreheads. So they're sealed. And then verse 5, and they were not permitted to kill anyone. So just to torment them. But to torment for 5 months. There's a specific time frame. And their torment was like the torment of scorpions when it stings a man. So very horrendous. Tremendous destruction, tremendous suffering, tremendous torment, and tremendous pain. God is judging. Now keep in mind, here's the key to understanding judgment. A lot of people have a hard time with God's judgment. God is resolving the problem of evil that he's promised to do, and he's coming to the consummation of that resolution. All of us desire that God eliminate and deal with sin, and these judgments are God intervening in history to resolve the problem of evil. So from our perspective, and in fact, in chapter 4 that introduces this great tribulation, and this is the application we should draw, we should worship God for what he's doing. Look past the horrendousness. That's part of what God must do. In fact, that's what chapter 4 says. It outlines what God must, in other words, by divine necessity, resolve the problem of evil, and it's painful. It shows us how horrendous sin is. But this is the attitude that we should have. Then I looked and I heard the voice of many angels around the throne. This introduces us to the period, chapters 4 and 5. This is 5:11. I should have put a slide up there. Around the throne and the living creatures and the elders, and the number of them was myriads and myriads and thousands, saying with a loud voice, "Worthy is the Lamb." The Lamb is the Lord Jesus Christ. To remind us that it's the same Christ that is the Passover Lamb that was sacrificed, but now this is the resurrected Lamb. It's the same personage, and he is the one that is orchestrating these events. Particularly in chapter 6, it makes it clear. And this is the attitude, saying with a loud voice, "Worthy is the Lamb that was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing." And then every living creature which is in heaven and on earth and under the earth and under the sea and all things in them, saying, "To him who sits on the throne," that's the Father, "and to the Lamb be blessing, honor, glory," etc. Worship. They're worshiping God because he's resolving the problem of evil, as horrendous and as painful as it may be to our thinking. It is necessary, and this is what God is doing. So some of these little snippets of the judgments, keep reminding yourself, we should worship God because that's what he must do to resolve the problem of evil. And I mentioned, somewhat by application, what we are seeing in our culture today, and I don't want to spend a lot of time, but just kind of touch on them. I saw from one of the passages today probably there's a leadership vacuum that's going to be filled by a very powerful, very influential, very dynamic, very interesting individual. And we saw hints of that already. Deception is going to increase to its highest level as ever been seen, never been seen at this scale in world history. We saw kind of hints of that because it's going to appear during this period of time. Cultural decline, this is what we see today. We see an increase in deception today. We see a leadership vacuum. The stage may be set for the introduction of this period of time. We saw that, I just emphasized the demonic activity. There's a lot of that going on today. Don't want to get into the details. Terrorism is going to increase, and you have examples of that in the text itself, on a global scale even. And then after the fifth and sixth judgments, we have an interlude. Chapters 10, kind of introductory to the next phase that we have here. And particularly chapter 11, and let me highlight a couple of things there. And I will grant authority to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy, and here's the number, here's the chronology, 1,260 days. What's another 3.5 years? So you have these little phrases throughout the book of Revelation. Sometimes it's in days. Sometimes it's in, how many months would that be? 42 months. There's a text that announces it. Very specific. I will grant authority to my two witnesses. Now, it kind of backtracks. I think this is at the very beginning. In fact, it makes a lot of sense to put it initially at the very, very beginning of this seven-year chronology. So they prophesy. And in the middle, chapter 11 is going to tell us that they're going to be martyred, basically. And they will prophesy for 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. They're mourning. Verse 5, "And if anyone wants to harm them, fire flows out of their mouths and devours their enemies." Verse 6, "These have the power to shut up the sky so that rain will not fall," etc. They're able to turn blood or water into blood and bring every plague. Now, there's all kinds of debate as to who these personages might be. One little clue might be, and my conclusion is, two of them appeared at the transfiguration of Jesus Christ. Anyone remember who they are? Moses and Elijah. And in fact, we have a description of what appears to be them. Notice their powers. Elijah called fire from heaven and consumed 50 men from 2 Kings 1 through 10 and the altars of Baal. Elijah shut the sky. That seems to be alluded here. Moses brings plagues on Egypt. And that's what we have in the biblical text. So we have the resurrection, perhaps Elijah and Moses come back. And they're probably the prophets, prophet of Israel. Now, chronologically, it makes sense that they would initiate a great revival during this period of time. That's the only positive thing. In fact, the tribulation has at least two purposes. One, God is cleansing, you might say, the earth through judgment. So he's bringing judgment, not only on mankind, but the earth itself and everything on the earth. But the second thing that God is doing is he's fulfilling prophecies concerning the nation of Israel. And this is where Paul in Romans 11 tells us all Israel shall be saved, and it's during this seven-year period. That's the only positive thing about the Great Tribulation. Now, judgment, if you look at it from the perspective of God resolving evil, that's positive too, but it's horrendous and very destructive, you might say. So on our timeline here of the 7 years, I think what God does is the initiation of it is a covenant that Daniel talks about, and we have hints of it in another chapter in the book of Revelation, but somewhat at the very beginning, because it says 3.5 years, so it's precise, we have two prophets, probably those described in chapter 11. And we already saw in chapter 7 the result of them. Now, this is my best arrangement of the events here. From some of the data, like the 3.5 years that we saw, or the 1,250 days, or how many was it, 1,250? I take it that these prophets, because there's another chronological note with the 144,000, they come about at the very beginning as well. They're sealed before the judgments come. So I think they're the first ones to respond, and it makes sense that now they go out into the world, or they're already out in the world, and they evangelize others, and many are saved, most of them martyred, as chapter 6 indicates. And then we have massive conversions, the greatest revival the world has ever seen. Scale, the scope of the book of Revelation. And we also have persecution and martyrdom of the converts, which are also alluded to. I didn't give you the passages. And then in chapter 11, the two are killed, the two prophets. So they manifest themselves, and then they're raised again. And that takes place in the middle, after 3.5. Chapter 12 and 13, there's a kind of a shift from events to personages. So I break that down all the way through verse 14. Main characters, chapters 12 and 13. And a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman. And so we have symbolism. We have visuals here. And most of the book of Revelation is based on the Old Testament. And if you go to the Old Testament, all the way to the book of Genesis, you have imagery here that reminds you of a vision that Joseph had of a woman. And here is a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars, and she was with child. I think if you work through the symbolism and the imagery here, a conclusion, I think there's enough evidence to conclude that this is a picture of Israel. And she cried out, being in labor and in pain, to give birth. The man-child is probably her child, the Messiah. And another sign appeared in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon. So you have another visual here. Having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads were 7 diadems, and his tail swept away 1/3 of the stars of heaven. This goes back to even before. In fact, I view chapter 12 somewhat like some of you may have, well, maybe not anymore, you have everything in your computer. Some of you more mature people probably had a shoebox full of these photographs that someday you anticipated or hoped to organize into an album and put them in there, but now you have all this on your computer. So this may not make sense to you young people. But it's almost like what John is giving us here is like a shoebox full of photographs, old-time photographs. And he pulls one, and he sees a woman, and he describes what's in the photograph. Pulls another one, he sees a man-child, and he goes back and forth. And one image here is he sees this dragon, and it shows, it goes all the way before creation when a third of the angels fell with Satan. So this, the dragon represents Satan. And when the dragon saw that he was thrown down to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. And it's picturing during the 7 year, and in fact throughout their history, persecution of the nation of Israel, anti-Semitism. But the two wings of a great eagle were given to the woman. This is future, so God is going to protect the woman so that she could fly into the wilderness to her place. I'll let you read the details. So we have a woman, we have a man-child, we have a dragon, there's some other things in there that I'm not highlighting. And then in chapter 13, we have another personage. The dragon stood on the sand of the seashore, then I saw a beast. So a picture of a beast coming out of the sea. This beast is from God's perspective. In other words, he's a beastly, horrendous character, having 10 horns, horns probably, powers, nations, 7 heads on his horns, etc. Chapter 13 describes a personage, and then there's another beast. Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had 2 horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon. So he has satanic words, you might say. He's inspired. We have the incarnation, what appears to be the incarnation of Satan himself. Probably in a human, another human personage. Well, the beast is the incarnation. This gives glory to the beast. And what I think we have here is an unholy trinity described in chapter 13. The dragon represents Satan himself. First beast, the incarnation of the dragon, who impersonates a messianic personage, the Antichrist. And then the second beast gives glory to the first beast, and the book of Revelation calls him a false prophet. And one of the things that's stressed in chapter 13 is they will establish a global empire. It'll be worldwide, and he will, in fact, rule all of the nations. And other passages kind of support this globalism idea. And what is a major talk in the United Nations and amongst leaders and people that are influencers is the only way we're going to solve our problems is globalism. It's not going to be established until the church, I think, is gone. So globalism is emphasized in our culture. Just little hints that the stage may be set. And then chapter 14 is ultimate victory in different little areas. A lot of different little paragraphs in there. Then we have the final plagues, 15 through 18. And we have the outpouring of wrath. Chapter 15 is somewhat an interlude leading up to chapter 16. And we have the outpouring of wrath. Then I heard a loud voice from the temple saying to the 7 angels, go and pour out on the earth the 7 bowls of the wrath of God. So you have another set of judgments. If the first 2 sets weren't enough, God is very thorough in resolving the problem of evil, so he's bringing more judgments, 3 sets. 7 bowls, that's why they're called bowl judgments, or vial, depending on your translation, vial judgments. And we have more wrath poured out. Human sores, Sea turns to blood. Rivers turn to blood. So more comprehensive judgments that go beyond those four that we described that come in thirds. Now we have totality here. Scorching heat. The beast is darkened and his kingdom comes under judgment, which we want. The Euphrates is dried up to allow 200 million to come and invade. And then there's the seventh bowl judgment are these various cataclysms that resemble the sixth bowl judgment. That's why I see these as parallel. I think they're the same or closely related. So that's chapter 16. So I see them in parallel, seal judgments, and some word doesn't give us a time frame, bowl judgment, and more intense and closer to the very end, I see the bowl judgments paralleling each other. And again, different commentators will take different views in terms of the relationship. This is one that you can consider, and it's what makes the most sense to me. And this is during this seven-year tribulation that emphasizes chapters 4 through 11 seem to emphasize the events, and then 12 through 16 seems to emphasize various personages. And by the way, another personage just mentioned in one verse is an angel proclaims the gospel. So the gospel will be proclaimed throughout the world during this period of time. No one will have the excuse that they didn't hear about the Messiah, about the Lord Jesus Christ. So there's going to be a whole group of new believers. Most of them will be martyred. Now, I wouldn't call the believers in that time the church. I think that they're described as saints. Much like the Old Testament. The church is not in the Old Testament. I don't see the church in the tribulation or a different church. I think the church is very unique. And it has a beginning, the day of Pentecost, and it has an end, the rapture. And that's what I think when the Bible uses that word, it refers to. Now, you do have new believers there. But they're not part of the church. The church is resurrected. This is just a group of believers that are not named. They're saints, is the way the book of Revelation describes them. Then verse 16, and I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon and out of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet, three unclean spirits like frogs. So very weird, very strange. For they are spirits of demons performing signs which go out to the kings of the whole earth to gather them together for the war of the great day. This is World War III. So World War III is not going to, we're not going to see World War III. Politicians are talking about that, the problems in the Middle East right now. That's not till the end of the seven-year period of time. This is one of the bowl judgments. And then verse 15 or 16, and they gathered them together to the place which in Hebrew is called Har Mageddon. And there's actually a site, those of us that went to Israel visited Megiddo, where you can overlook the Jezreel Valley where this battle will in fact take place. So that's World War III. So there's not going to be a World War III in spite of what people fear. Until later, there might be ongoing wars, and there may be some very tragic things that we see, but World War III is not until the end. So those are the expectations as we look at current events and try to think. We should always be ready for the coming of the Lord, but these might remind us to be ready for him because we will escape the actual fulfillments. And by the way, I don't see, for example, in the Olivet Discourse, a lot of Bible teachers see us in the beginning stages that are described in Matthew 24, the birth pangs as well, Jesus describes them. I see all of Matthew 24 as Jewish as well, Jewish audience, Jewish disciples. And there are some parallels with what Jesus says, the beginning of birth pangs, with the seal judgments. So I see them as parallel to the seal judgments. No fulfillments. One major fulfillment is the reestablishing of the nation of Israel, but I don't see fulfillments today, just the setting, possible setting of the stage. Make sense? So don't read into Matthew 24, wars and rumors of wars is describing what's going on today. Famines, earthquakes, and those sort of things, as some do. I think all of that is parallel and takes place during the seven-year period. So that concludes our tribulation period. Well, there's one more thing. Final plagues. There's more plagues, 15 through 18, including the bowl judgments. 17 and 18, well, I already went over this. I think this slide's out of sequence here. Oh, particular wrath. Focus is on Babylon, Babylon the Great, the harlot. And what that may be, my conclusion is the world system of that time, in other words, the world system of Antichrist and his kingdom. I think that's Babylon that has three aspects to it. It has political aspects, religious aspects. And what's the third one? Political, social. That didn't sound right. I'll have to think of it. So, the particular wrath, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, come here, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot. More imagery. Now, you can go back to the Old Testament. The major enemy of Israel, the one that destroyed the nation of Israel and took them into captivity, was Babylon. So the imagery of Babylon, in fact, Babylon, the imagery goes all the way to Babel. And this global idea, which was present at Babel, and Babylon was a global power that dominated everything, destroyed the nation of Israel. So I think that imagery goes back to ancient Babylon, and there's going to be a revived Babylon, if you will. In fact, I believe there'll be a revived city of Babylon itself. So the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, she's pictured as a harlot, false worship. And here you go on verse 5, and on her head a name was written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. So there's a satanic source of false worship centered in this imagery of Babylon. So that's basically the tribulation period. The last part, third division, at least in my outline, 19 through the end of the book, 22, is the consummation by Jesus Christ. Not only is he orchestrating judgments, and he uses all kinds of means. He will use natural means. He will use angelic means. He will use direct involvement. These judgments come about on the earth, but he will end them. There's a consummating event. We call it the second coming, described in chapter 19, 1 through 16. Just a few verses there. Verse 11, in fact, preceding it, is great worship, much like what we have earlier. In fact, a major theme. There are several scenes of worship. So that's the major application we should draw, is the book of Revelation should cause us to worship God for what he will, in fact, accomplish. Things that we yearn for. We want evil to be dealt with. We want it to be resolved. And we know and are assured that he will, in fact, deal with it, and we can worship him. So verses 11 through 12, and I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse. Now, the first seal judgment, we saw a white horse, but that's a counterfeit. That's an impersonator. This white horse, he who sat on it, is called faithful and true. He's the only true and faithful one. And in righteousness, he judges and wages war. Notice, judgment is attributed to him. He's a judge. He is the judge. And part of that judgment includes war. His eyes are a flame of fire. In other words, he has omniscient intellect to be able to see and discern and separate out evil from that wants to be preserved. He wants to preserve. His eyes are a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems. So he has crowns, and he has a name written on him which no one knows except himself. There's lots of surprises that God has for us. Here's one of them. And the actual interpretation of some of these passages may be surprising as we perhaps view them from a heavenly perspective. It's a description, one of the clearest descriptions of the second coming of Christ in Revelation chapter 19. We have another description elsewhere, but this is the Olivet Discourse, for example, is briefer. This is the more extended one, emphasizing his perfections or his attributes. So the second coming is introduced with great rejoicing, great worship, first 10 verses, and what I just mentioned here, 11 through 16, is a description of the return itself. The second coming is the theme of the whole book, as I mentioned at the very beginning. Everything before is just introductory. So you might consider the 18 chapters as introductory to the coming or the description of the coming of our Lord. That's Walvoord's statement. And we have a reign of the bride. In fact, the bride is introduced to us in chapter 19, the marriage supper of the bride. That is the church. Now, the church, it's a heavenly scene. The church is not on earth. So I believe that the pre-tribulation rapture is the accurate or the more biblical view of all of the several views. And the word church doesn't occur through after chapter 3. The church, the word ecclesia does not appear until John gives the conclusion and Jesus encourages John to put together the book of Revelation and send it to the seven ecclesias, or seven churches. But we do have a heavenly picture, and I think, and there's some other hints. Chapter 4, there's a couple of hints. The 24 elders that are in that heavenly scene, that's probably a picture of the church. And then here we have the bride in chapter 19. And there's different views on it. Old Testament saints, Israel in the church, dedicated saints. The bride, I think, is the church. And then God comes, second coming, judgment, God separating evil from good, God bringing an end to world history. And that brings us to kind of a breakdown of these chapters and my outline, squelching. I'm using S to alliterate. Sometimes I alliterate. Squelching of enemies. 19:17, verse 17 through 21, just a sampling of it, verse 19. And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies. So this is the empire of Antichrist, the beast. Assembled to make war, referring back. That's looking back at this third world war against him who sat on the horse and against his army, against the Lord Jesus Christ. Who's the army? We return with him. And the beast was seized, and with him the false prophet. So the two members, the earthly members of the unholy Trinity, who performed the signs in his presence by which he deceived those who had received the mark. There's the deception. Deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. That's chapter 13. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire, which burns with brimstone. So he's separating out, judging the most evil personages that appear on the earth, casting them. And by the way, the lake of fire is hell. Lake of fire. So we have the second coming. We have the squelching of enemies. We have the seizure of Satan, chapter 20. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven holding the key of the abyss. Remember, we had a reference to the abyss. This is a demonic place. And a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold of the dragon. So now we're going to deal with the ultimate in evil, the dragon. Now, he's not going to be eliminated immediately. But 2 and 3 tells us the serpent of old. In other words, it defines who the dragon is. So there's no question. So when you're in chapter, introduced? Chapter 12. And you're wondering, who is the dragon? Here, the book of Revelation gives you the interpretation. Who is the devil? So the dragon is Satan himself. And Satan, if that's not clear enough. And bound him for 1,000 years. So there's still 1,000 years of world history on earth. But he is bound. So you can't blame Satan during that 1,000 years if you are mortal and living there. You can't blame the world because Jesus Christ is ruling and he's going to rule in righteousness. The only thing that's left to blame is the depravity of man's own flesh. And he threw him into the abyss and shut it and sealed it over so that he would not deceive the nations any longer until the 1,000 years were completed. After these things, he must, the Greek word day, by divine necessity, must be released for a short time because God still needs to resolve the problem of evil that crops up during the millennial kingdom. Make sense? So we have the squelching of enemies, the seizure of Satan, and now the saints in the millennium, chapter 20, verse 4 through 6. The rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were completed. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is the one who has a part in the first resurrection. In other words, the resurrection of believers comes in stages. The rapture is one of the first stages. Actually, the resurrection of Christ would be the first fruits. And then the rapture of the church. And there's probably a rapture that's not mentioned before the millennial kingdom. Blessed and holy is the one who has part in the first resurrection. Over these, the second death has no power. So it has stages, but it's called the first resurrection. But they will be priests of God and of Christ and will reign with him for 1,000 years. So we are part of that group, probably Old Testament believers. There's some specific passages that tell us that David will rule in the millennial kingdom, in the context of those Old Testament passages. Christ will be Lord of lords and King of kings, but David will rule. You may rule, maybe South Valley or something, you know. Who knows? But we will rule. So there are two groups that are part of the millennium, and here's another timeline, 1,000 years, the 7 years before. So there are spiritual beings that will be in the millennial kingdom. So that will include the church. It'll also include perhaps the Old Testament believers and those that die during the, or that become believers during the tribulation. So I separate them out as not part of the church. But those that survive, in other words, those that survive that 7-year period in mortal bodies, that's described in the Olivet Discourse, Matthew 24 and 25, and also somewhat hinted at here in the book of Revelation. They will survive in mortal bodies, so they'll have temptation, they'll live, they'll die. Isaiah 65:20 talks about even death during in a millennial context. So the ones that survive that are members of Israel, that are part descendants of Abraham, that are believers, will enter the kingdom in mortal bodies. And they will carry on. This is part of world history. There will be life for 1,000 years. And there will also be living nations, Matthew chapter 25, beginning in verse 20 or 31, I believe. That's the Olivet Discourse. So all of these will occupy. It's going to be an unusual period of time. You and I will have a ministry there. We will have rulership. If you're faithful, you can lose your reward. But if you're faithful, you will have rulership. You will judge angels. You'll judge the nations. The 12 apostles, the one that substitutes for Judas, that's why we have Acts 1 to replace him, because Matthew, 19:28, I believe. Look that one up. It says that the 12 apostles will, in fact, rule the 12 tribes of Israel. It's during the millennial kingdom. So sin after the millennium and the second death. So there's still sin during the millennium. And that's that great battle. Then I saw a great white throne, and here's the final resolution of evil. And I saw the great white throne and him who sat on it, and I saw the dead. Here's the second resurrection. The dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne, and books were opened, and the dead were judged from the things which were written in the books according to their deeds. So there's going to be a final judgment. This is the great white throne judgment, where the problem of evil will be ultimately and totally resolved. And it'll be after that that Satan himself will be cast into the lake of fire. So now there's no more evil. And now we basically go into the eternal state. So that's the second death. Chapter 20, verses 11 through 15. And the judgment that takes place where the resolution of evil is completed. That's why all of the believers in heaven and the angels, in fact, all of creation, worship God. And that's what we should do as well. So the eternal state, then I saw a new heaven and new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and there is no longer any sea. So this is eternity. And I saw the holy city. There's going to be a new Jerusalem, new created Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. And then we have the conclusion of the book, which is kind of just an epilogue. John is instructed to write these things down, a few final exhortations and warnings, concluding the book. And we can conclude by worshiping our sovereign Lord, who will restore all things, not just our ultimate salvation, but he's going to restore the earth and create a new heavens and a new earth, where sin will never have a part again.